Thanks for downloading this podcast. It's for personal use only and must not be broadcast, reproduced, or used in any form without permission.
Tell your friends they can get their own copy wherever they get their podcasts.
The most comprehensive coverage of the world's greatest motor race anywhere on the planet. This is Haggerty Radio Le Mans.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome to another special programme here on Haggerty Radio Le Mans 91.2 FM for 2023. I'm John Hindhoff, and we're looking at the 100th year anniversary edition of the Le Mans 24 Hours. And in this programme, we'll be taking a look at the 16, yes, count them, 16 top class cars. The hypercar class has really come of age. And in addition to the WEC entries, who obviously have to be here as it's part of the championship, we've got some additional cars as well. One or two changes to the lineups that you might be just getting your heads around. We'll go through all of them for you in this show. The good news for you is it's not just me whining on about this. We've actually got somebody who knows what they're talking about. And that is our ace statistician and broadcaster. And indeed, he is now a race tactician as well. And that is Paul Truswell. Hello, Paul.
Hello, John. You're very kind. I think like you, actually, I'm basically just a fan. And, you know, some people have Christmas every year. We have Le Mans every year. And you're right. It's going to be special this year, isn't it?
It's special for so many reasons, not least what we've mentioned, the reasons that we've mentioned for the 100th anniversary. But when you look at this top class of hypercars, it is quality all the way through. And it's not finished yet. I mean, not wishing away this year's race, but still to come, there's plenty more in 24 and potentially 25, possibly even at the end of this WEC season. Is this tantamount to the ACO and IMSA getting the convergence right and basically that sort of chat, those, for want of a better word, hands across the ocean and the convergence, that clearly was the right thing to do, and the manufacturers have supported it?
Well, yes, and it's been something that people have been talking about for years. You know, why do we have such a spread, you know, of what sports car racing is all about? Why can't cars that race at Daytona race at Le Mans and all these kind of questions? It makes sense to bring them together. And, you know, you've said the word hands across the ocean, convergence. Yes, it is. It is being reflected in what's happened at Le Mans this year. 16 entries of hypercar is more, I suspect, than even the ACO would have hoped for 12 months ago. Yeah. I'll take issue on one thing you said a moment ago, which was coming of age. I don't think we've quite come of age yet. We're kind of preschoolers, if you see what I mean.
Very good.
Because we haven't yet seen anybody challenge Toyota, and we'll get onto the detail of that, I'm sure, in a minute. But the way that the WEC has gone so far this year, whilst there has been a lot of competition, and while we do have these 16 entries, look at the results, and they're pretty much the story that we've seen in previous years. So I think we've got some way to go. We've got some maturing to go.
Very good.
But at least we've got the pieces in place, we've got the right building blocks in place, we've got the right rule book, and we seem to have the manufacturers, the participants, playing the game. They're being constrained quite a lot by the regulations, but we're not hearing a lot of bleating about the regulations not being right.
That's very true.
Yes, we're hearing some, but it's kind of being kept fairly low key, and I think that's a good thing.
Let's get into the cars themselves. Within the category, there are effectively three slightly different rule sets. I don't want to go massively.
You're starting off with the hardest question.
Yes, and I know that. to bring this together, to have this convergence, there was never going to be a one-size-fits-all. And I actually think that that was one of the better decisions that was made. Nobody should be forced into one set of regulations or the other. It is obvious, and it's been obvious for a decade or so, that what works, particularly in IMSA and some of the other championships, might not work in a world championship or vice versa. And the opportunity for manufacturers like Cadillac, like Porsche, also Acura, who aren't here, Honda, who aren't here at Le Mans, but surely can't be too long. BMW will be here next year, as will Lamborghini. To create a top flight prototype at a quote-unquote reasonable cost, nothing in racing is ever cheap, has meant that there's been three somewhat different interpretations, and those rules have had to all be accommodated within the overall hypercar class. It kind of doesn't help that there is one class of car called hypercars, then we've got LMDHs, and then we've got hypercar hybrids as well. So hypercars are generally speaking the ACO and FIA versions. There's two versions of that. There's a two-wheel drive non-hybrid version, and there's a four-wheel drive hybrid version. The LMDH cars, GTP, when they race in the States, that's the name of their top class, are still quite sophisticated cars, but only two-wheel drive, but they do still have a hybrid, and that drives the rear wheels. The job that nobody wants, Paul, is trying to balance these three different philosophies, dare I say, of racing cars.
One thing that nobody wants it. I think everybody would have their turn at specifying it. but I see exactly what you mean. And I think they've done a pretty good job. Mm-hmm. Because you've described it very well. But at the end of the day, a hypercar is a hypercar is a hypercar. True. And if you look at the performance differences between those cars, there is very little to choose. Mm. What has been the difference in the season so far has been the ability of the teams to translate that performance into a full 6 or 8 hours, as it was at Sebring, and at Le Mans, obviously, the full 24 hours. But the performance, the actual speed that the car can do around a lap, where it's gaining, where it's losing, long straights, high-speed corners, slow-speed corners, you've got these different configurations of cars. But the balance has been pretty well achieved, for my money, and the technical staff, the technical committee of the ACO has to be congratulated, or FIA has to be congratulated for getting it pretty much right, in my view. And as I say, the people who have come out top have been the people who have performed all round, not simply the team that has had the fastest car.
Well, that's a very interesting and, I think, apposite point that you've made there, because there will be people who will just look at the results. We know there are people listening to Haggerty Radio Le Mans on 91.2 FM or around the world on RS1 who perhaps this is the only major endurance race that they'll be involved in this year. And if they do look at the results, they'll say, well, nothing's changed. Toyota's winning. They've executed, though, Paul. And this new era of balance of performance in the top class in particular is based on performance potential, total performance potential from data that has been gathered by IMSA on their side of the Atlantic and here in Europe by the ACO and the FIA, taking cars, putting them in wind tunnels, running their own sensor sets on them, and basically they've come up with a performance potential for each of those cars. The clear thing to me, and I think you've made this point very well, not every one of the teams or manufacturers have yet unlocked 100% of that performance potential.
No, and winning an endurance race is in any case about more than just making the car go as fast as it can.
Yep.
You know, you've got to make it comfortable to drive. You've got to make it easy on the tyres. You've got to be quick in the pits. You've got to make it reliable, da-di-da-di-da, all the things that we troll out. But it's true. And for my money, performance is only one aspect. And, you know, you're right, you can kind of look, take a very one-dimensional or a two-dimensional view of it and say, oh, yes, well, Toyota's the top of the heap. And they come into Le Mans 2023 as odds-on favourites, let's face it.
Yes, yeah.
But, you know, what if you look at the speed that the Ferrari has, the speed indeed that the Cadillac has, the history that Porsche has, you know, you're not going to shoo Toyota onto the top seven of the podium just yet, because for the first year in a number of years, they've got some sensible competition up against them.
Let's start with Toyota. They are defending champions at both race winners at Le Mans and indeed the championship, as you say. They've not had huge competition down through the years. I don't blame them for that. We had Audi dominating for the better part of a decade. You can only race who turns up. Well, there's more people turned up, as Paul Truswell's just said. The GRO10 hybrid is an evolution of what they've had before. There's been some detailed changes at the start of the season, mainly the things that you can see are a little bit more aero work on the top of the car. They've changed the balance of the car a little bit. But that is clearly, Paul, still a very capable prototype racing car. And crucially, it is a car that they are comfortable with and they know very well. And that's before you add the driving talent of the 7 and the 8 together, who, let's be fair, are pretty good.
Yes, I mean, the drivers... how to put this, they've got the experience, they know what to do, they've been here before, they have what it takes to make the difference in this year's race. The car is a known quantity. The mechanics, the team engineers, they know what to do. They've practiced everything. They know what it's like to work in the constraints of a Le Mans pit lane. They know what their garage layout looks like. You know, they've got the same boards up to go around the garage as they had last year because they take the same garage year after year after year. They have all of that experience to draw upon before you even get to looking at the performance of the car,
yep,
which is clearly was the class of the field last year. And dare I say it, will only have to go as quick as it did last year in order to win again this year.
Yep.
I'd like to be proven wrong on that. I'd like to see them have to go further, but we'll see how it pans out. But all the pieces are in place for Toyota. And as I say, I think the biggest part of their advantage actually comes from that driver lineup. It's the identical crews that raced here last year. And as I say, they've all had experience of winning.
I don't know how you pick between them, to be honest. In the 7, Toyota is Toyota Gazoo racing car is Mike Conway, Kami Kobayashi and Jose Maria Lopez. Their teammates in the number 8 GRO10 are Seb Buemi, Brendan Hartley and Ryo Hirakawa, who settled in rather nicely into that number 8 car.
Hasn't he just, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really impressive from him, from the other two drivers as well, because coming into an established team, as he had to not so very long ago, that is never an easy thing to do. And keeping the balance within the team, I think they're both very strong crews. I can't honestly choose between them. A couple of years ago, I might have said that Jose Maria Lopez wasn't quite at the caliber of the other drivers. I'm not sure that's true now. And even if it is, the difference is much, much smaller.
No, I think that's right. I mean, I've listened to you attentively over the years, and you were a bit impolite about Pechito's driving sometimes. But certainly, I don't think he's the weak link in the chain, if any of them are. You know, the one that you would expect to is, as you say, Hirakawa, as the newcomer into the team. But, you know, he came in last year, did a perfectly good job, won the race. You know, what more can you ask? I have my personal favourites, but that's only because I happen to be a Mike Conway fan. Make no bones about it. That's not to say I've got anything against Buemi and Brendan Hartley. But I think the 7 car has had some... unfortunate luck at Le Mans especially.
Yep.
And so if I was to choose between them, I'd be choosing the number 7 ahead of the number 8. But that's for no good reason at all, as I say, apart from a personal liking for Mike Conway and the way he goes about his racing. He's a very committed driver. And as you say, the teammates, I mean, Kobayashi, who'd bet against him putting it on pole again?
Specialist, isn't he? He's a qualifying specialist at Le Mans. And I mean, that hyperpole session, not everybody likes it, but you can't deny it's entertaining. And it gives Kamui in particular the opportunity to do something that in years past you might not have been able to do with so much
get a clear track.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Right.
No, absolutely. No, and as I say, the drivers know themselves. I mean, you briefly spoke about the years of Audi domination that we had a decade or so ago. We're going through a period of Toyota domination. But by keeping the drivers together, they get to know one another. They get to know the little foibles. The whole thing works together as a... you know, use the cliche, finely tuned machine.
Yeah.
You know, but it's important. And I think Toyota has come from a team of eager individuals to now being a very good team. And, you know, you look at the two cars and they work together as a team. And that's something that Audi did so well as well, of course.
That's the two Toyota Gazoo Racing entries, Japanese flagged, of course, works teams coming out of Cologne in Germany, the 7 and the 8. Their closest competitors this year in terms of pace, and we've seen some great racing at the front of the field, has come from the 50 and 51 Ferraris, the AF Corsa Ferraris, again, a works team, but for some strange strategy and some mistakes from their drivers, they may have done even better than just getting the pole position at Sebring. That was huge for them, for Antonio Forcut, who shares his car with Miguel Molina and Nicholas Nilsson, whereas it's Alessandro Pagidi, James Calado, and Antonio Giovinazzi in the other car. No doubt about the speed of that Ferrari. It looks fantastic. I stood trackside at the prologue at Sebring and watching it go through the very bumpy turn one. It looked exceptionally unspectacular and just seemed, whereas everybody else was tuning the cars, the Cadillac was perhaps the best over the bumps. The Toyota didn't look great. The Peugeot looked, frankly, like it was trying to kill its drivers every time it went round turn one. The Ferrari sort of went round and then went round and then went round. It's got a fairly unspectacular engine note from the 3-litre V6 engine, but it has been good. And this is a team still learning their craft in AF Corsa in this class, Paul. And maybe that has been the difference this year between them and Toyota.
Yes, it's very difficult, isn't it? Because Ferrari AF Corsa is such a new team. So, you know, I draw a lot on data. I draw a lot on history of what's happened in order to try and predict what's going to happen. And we don't have much of that history to draw on with the Ferraris. They're undoubtedly quick, and as you say, that pole position at Sebring puts a lot of eyebrows raised. And, you know, it was a perfectly fair pole position and a stupendous performance from Fuoco. But the best result has been a second, hasn't it?
Yeah.
This year, they managed to keep Toyota from doing a 1-2 every time of the season so far. And they were third in the most recent race at Spa-Francorchamps. So it's a quick car. AF Corsa is undoubtedly one of the best teams to come out of GT racing, the GT side of racing. They've got a huge pool of resources to draw upon. So they've been able to select people from in-house. They've been able to go out and headhunt as well. So they've got a good experienced team running them. Two things. One is that as you say, it's a new car. They're still learning their craft. They've got to learn about the car. Would you bet on it being 100% reliable over 24 hours? Don't know. The thing that worries me most, though, is the driver lineup.
Right.
I mean, yes, they're all good drivers. They're all quick drivers. But they lack that experience at Le Mans that the Toyota drivers can deliver. You know, we've got first-time drivers in the car, at Le Mans at least. Actually, no, that's not true. They've all been to Le Mans before. But certainly at this level, they're brand new. And however, having said so, that's my concern, is the driver lineup. You know, getting them to work together when little things go wrong and the little niggles go wrong. Somebody said to me recently that driving in a Le Mans car is a bit like being on a submarine for a three month tour. You're very close to one another,
yeah,
and all the little things that you think you can cope with that annoy you suddenly do start annoying you at 2 o'clock in the morning, and little word gets said, somebody gets a nose put out of joint. You know, there's little personal things that start to happen. And at Le Mans, you can't afford that. So you have to be very careful. And as I say, that's my concern about the Ferrari team. Having said that, I am absolutely 100% certain that they will turn up at Le Mans with a much stronger works backing and much more in the way of support, technical support, you know, massagers, people who know about suspension and all the things that's important. They will absolutely throw the kitchen sink at it at AF Corsa. So they'll be far better supported at Le Mans than they have been in the races thus far in the season.
Anyone who thinks that Ferrari aren't taking this seriously and it's really only here because of the F1 cost cap and it allows them to keep some clever people and charge some of their time to something else. Well, that part of that might actually be true about the cost cap, but they are taking this seriously. They're on a crest of a wave at the moment. The new 296 won at the 24 hours, that's the GT car, the GT3 car, run at the 24 hours of the Nürburgring recently. There was an awfully large Ferrari prototype technical presence there. The engine is basically the same unit between the two cars. 499, by the way, is the individual cylinder cubic capacity. And there's a lot of back and forth between those two projects. It's very clever. Some of it is feeding back into Formula One for the next set of engine regulations in particular. But they are taking this very seriously indeed. And I think they possibly even surprised themselves early on with the car's pace. They've got to make sure it's reliable. Both Toyota and Ferrari will be delighted after the issues that they had with drivers not able to control their cars on cold tyres with front wheel spinning induced accidents, torque steer accidents, they turn off the traction control when they come out the pits on cold tyres. And both Brendan Hartley and, was it Fuoco again? No, it was Per Guidi, wasn't it, who had the accident coming out of the pits. At Spa, correct.
Yeah.
For one race only, FIA, WEC and the ACO have brought back tyre warmers. I think those two, of all of the teams, they'll be very happy. It wasn't something that particularly befell the two-wheel drive cars. I think they'll be very happy about that. What that does to the balance of performance, and particularly on the outlap and how people set the cars up, I'm not entirely certain because I'm not that clever and I'm not a suspension and geometry engineer. However, that little question mark in the back of the driver's minds, at least, Paul, has largely been taken away.
Yes. And that's probably a good thing. I've had various debates with people since Spa and whether it's a good idea to ban the tyre warmers or not. And then when it was announced that they would be allowed for Le Mans, whether that was a good idea or not. It's a very knotty subject because mm-hmm. it's one of those questions to which the answer is always, well, it's the same for everyone. but I think the whole question of tyre wear is a difficult one. The way that WEC regulations goes limits the number of tyres that you're allowed to use so strictly that, I mean, Brendan Hartley's accident, you referred to it in a moment ago at Spa, which he had in qualifying, basically that affected the tyre utilisation for the whole of the rest of the race for that car.
Yeah.
And it wasn't able to, okay, the kid still came home in second place, but it was never going to beat the number seven car.
Yeah.
At Spa. And as I say, the way that tyre regulations work through the WEC, I find it almost a little bit too strict mm-hmm. that, you know, they could loosen up a little bit. You know, we're supposed to be at the top level of sports prototype racing. And, you know, you have certain restrictions on, which seem to make no sense at all under the auspices of, well, we're saving money or we're, you know, we're saving the planet, whatever you want to call it. And I think sometimes we get a little bit lost on those things.
Yeah.
And there's a piece of me that says, just let them throw as many tyres as they want to at it. you know, it's a cost, yes. And ultimately it's down to Michelin to come along and deliver enough tyres. But, you know, what are you actually achieving in the end? You know, you're trying to have a good race. And by handicapping people who make mistakes, if you will, but handicapping to the extent that they can't then recover from that mistake
yeah.
and make amends for it, I think it becomes a little bit too much. Do you get what I'm saying?
No, absolutely agree. I do think that particularly since we've gone back to the you can't fuel and tyre at the same time, then in some respects that is not self-policing, but if you can double stint your tyres, there is an absolute advantage in terms of your stationary pit time. If you want to make it that more relevant and perhaps increase that, then cut down the amount of people with wheel guns. That's the sort of thing you can do without potentially compromising on safety. But I also absolutely agree with you about it's the same for everyone. I have spoken to some P2 teams in particular, because everybody's got them all the way through the whole field, who are slightly disappointed because they felt they got an advantage in their outlaps with their drivers, and they feel that it'll level the playing field perhaps away from them, take their advantage away from particularly the drivers that they've got in the cars. It can be filed under the into the draw of you can't please all of the people all of the time.
Yeah,
I think
that's true.
Let's steer with the all-wheel drive cars, the hypercars that we're talking about at the moment for the 2023 24 Hours of Le Mans here on Haggerty Radio Le Mans 91.2 FM. It's Paul Truswell who is talking to me, John Heintorf. So we'll go to Peugeot Total Energies, to give them their full name, with the 93 and 94 car. This car, perhaps the most radical in terms of how they've interpreted the rule set, particularly in terms of drag and downforce coefficients. This is the car with no discernible rear wing. It looks like the Scale Extra car that you fired off into your mum's dining room table leg and haven't been bothered to glue it back on again. It takes some getting used to if you haven't seen it. It's got exceptionally clever underbody aerodynamics. If you get a chance to have a look underneath it, if the car's up in the air at any time, then you'll see how much work there is under the floor, and particularly around the sill edges of the car. But it's not been an easy berth for the Peugeot 9X8. It was a little bit later than they wanted it last year. It still seemed, when it came to Sebring, a little underdone, if I'm honest, Paul. They've changed the way the gearbox is actuated because they've had ongoing problems with that. They're talking about changing the type of the size of tyres now that they are using, because they're the only ones who use slightly different size rear tyres in this category. this is a car, if it's going to work anywhere, Paul, it's going to work at Le Mans. In some ways, it's what it was designed for, but it's not been easy for the return of Peugeot.
No, and I think if eyebrows were raised in surprise at the performance of Ferrari, then they've equally been raised at the lack of performance from Peugeot. On average, probably, it's about right. But Ferrari has come in with a bang, and Peugeot certainly has come in with a whimper. Very disappointing. You kind of find yourself looking for excuses. You know, did they haven't you just gone through some of them? You know, the car was late. They haven't had time to do the testing probably that they wanted to do. Have they been too radical with the design of the car? Yes, but, you know, Peugeot are the most recent of this new influx of manufacturers.
That's a very good point.
They should know what they're doing more than anybody. Particularly more than Ferrari, I would suggest. And they just haven't. You know, we haven't even spoken about the drivers, and I don't want to in a way, because it's even less in their hands than it is in the conceptualizers and the designers, and then those people who have put it into reality, the builders of the car. That, as you say, they're talking about, you know, having got it wrong and they need to do it differently and da-di-da. Shouldn't be happening. It's a bit of a disappointment. And yes, you're right. If it's going to work anywhere, it's going to work at Le Mans. But, you know, they have to take a 3%, 4% step forwards just to get on terms with everybody else, yeah. Bearing in mind that everybody else is going to take a step forward for Le Mans as well.
I applaud their attitude in wanting to do something different, and in fact that was absolutely why the regulations for hypercar were written the way they were, so that people could look at them and try and find something that worked for them, potentially for their marketing as well. We know that motor racing is financed by marketeers, whilst it might be run by engineers. It's not quite as varied in people's solutions as we had in the LMP1 hybrid early days, where we had three different answers to the same hybrid prototype question in terms of the hybrid side.
But I think, just sorry to interrupt, John, but it does go back to the kind of late Group C era, yeah, when suddenly everybody wanted to get into the ballpark, and as long as you came along with a car that was only going to use so much fuel, you could come along with any number of cylinders, any type, correct, of transmission, da-di-da. And so, yes, Peugeot should be congratulated for that, and tell you what, there's no doubt it looks like a Peugeot.
Oh, yes.
You know, totally. If I'm a Peugeot driver, I look at that car and say, yeah, that looks just like my 406.
Yep. I totally agree. They've embraced that part of the regulations. There was some thought that if things didn't pick up, they might not come to Le Mans and risk the nightmare that could happen. I'm not sure how true that was, but there has been some technical changes, as we mentioned. Maybe were there some green shoots of potential at Spa? Possibly there were, but there still seems to me a massive question mark over reliability of systems and fairly fundamental systems at that.
Yeah, that's true. And as I say, they certainly have to find something. I don't agree that the right thing to do is to pull the plug altogether or even step away and scratch your head, not before the most important race of the year.
This race, not even next year's Le Mans 24 Hour, is what that car was aiming towards. They eschewed the opportunity to compete last year because they wanted to work towards this year's race and get everything right. And I just don't think it's quite there yet, Paul.
No, and nor has there been signs. Just looking at one of the little performance graphs that I put together over the season so far, that they've been headed in the right direction. The car has stayed pretty much where it is from Sebring to Portimao to Spa. In fact, if anything, dropping away a little bit at Spa, which is possibly the circuit most like Le Mans. But anyway, so it's, as I say, it's not as if Peugeot have been working towards something and taking small steps at getting closer. They've not been falling away, but they've not been getting any closer.
A lot of this performance data, by the way, you can, if you pick up the current issue of Race Car Engineering, you'll be able to see Paul's musings here. He's gone, crunched a lot of data for Race Car Engineering, which, as you might imagine at this time of year, is focusing rather heavily on Le Mans and particularly on the front of the field. Right, that's the three manufacturers who have the hybrid hypercars, which ultimately have an engine driving the back wheels, and they are harvesting and therefore deploying their hybrid energy through the front wheels, so at that point they become all-wheel drive. I am not going to get right now into the thorny subject of at what speed and where and when and how much and energy levels, because that could all change before we get to the race. But suffice to say that all of those things are put into the BOP mixer, although it has been said, Thierry Bouvier, who is the head of the technical side of the ACO, said pretty early on that it was their intention, at least, to not make any changes fundamentally in the balance of performance until after Le Mans, with the hope that that would make people try very, very hard indeed and not try to hide any performance. We could debate that until the cows come home about whether that's going to work. I do like the way that they're doing the BOP with performance potential, with empirical data that they have gathered themselves. Whether you can ever trust a race team to give you what you expect in terms of what happens on the track, I honestly don't know. The other hybrid cars in the hypercar are IMSA's vision of the top class. This was supposed to be a class that was called GTP in IMSA, LMDH by the ACO and the rest of the world. And this was supposed to be based on the new LMP2 chassis, much in the way as the DPIs, the outgoing IMSA cars last year, were based on still the current chassis in LMP2 that we have. And therein lies the rub, because there are no new LMP2s, and the new LMP2 regulations have not yet been finalised. So what we've actually got is a set of racing cars that have been pretty much bespoke built for single manufacturers. There's a slight difference with Cadillac and Dallara, because they share the chassis with BMW. But in the other entries here, they have been specifically designed to a manufacturer's design now and philosophy. Now, whether that subsequently becomes LMP2 or whether LMP2 disappears altogether, that's a subject for a different program. However, what it does mean is we have some very sophisticated racing cars, and that should not be dismissed in this category. Yes, there are some spec parts, Paul, notably the hybrid drive and the battery packs. However, I think very significantly, the internal combustion engines have been left as an open category, and also the control systems, the software that marry the internal combustion engines, the brake-by-wire systems, and the deployment and harvesting of that hybrid power. The manufacturers and the teams have been allowed to develop those themselves. Philosophically, I like that idea. Not everybody has clearly quite got it right, particularly in the brake-by-wire system. But as I said, as a class, we absolutely cannot dismiss these cars as being also runs in performance potential. In fact, they are probably as quick, if not quicker, and certainly slightly more nimble than the heavier hypercars.
Yeah, I mean, all of that is true. I think what, you know, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. What we've found in the season so far is that the Cadillacs and Porsches haven't quite been on the pace of the Ferraris, but they have been ahead of the Peugeot. Mm-hmm. So they're not doing much wrong. The balance in terms of regulatory balance is about right. you know, looking at what the potential is of these cars, certainly the Cadillac. And for my money, the way Cadillac arrived at Sebring, slightly overshadowed perhaps by the Ferraris, but if the Ferraris hadn't have been there, I can guarantee we'd have been shouting about the Cadillacs, and weren't they close to the performance of the Toyotas?
I actually think that Laura Wontrup-Clauser, who's the head of Corvette and Cadillac Racing, Chevrolet Racing, I think in some ways they were quite pleased that the Ferrari got the limelight, because it allowed them to just go on doing what they were doing and progressing with their programme. Both Cadillac and Porsche, in the form of Cadillac Racing and Porsche Penske Motorsport, have had the advantage, of course, of doing some IMSA racing as well. It should be noted that whilst the Cadillac are in exactly the same racing spec as they race in IMSA, all of the ACO cars are slightly more draggy, and that's basically down to just slightly different wind tunnel results from the ACO using the tunnel in Hinville at Audi's F1 Sauber facility, and IMSA using the wind shear facility in Carolina. There are some detailed changes under the skin of the ACO cars, particularly with regard to wiring looms for what the teams call the scrutineering harness. It's actually more than that. It runs all the time so that the series can take live data from the cars. And they're significantly different between the two series. However, Porsche have taken the opportunity to have a slightly different rear bodywork design behind the rear wheels in the WEC cars and the IMSA cars. It's minor, but there's nothing to say that they can't, because basically the cars go through homologation for each of the two series. Let's start with the Cadillacs. It hasn't been all wine and roses in their preparation. The WEC entered car, the number two car for Earl Bamber, Alex Lynn and Richard Westbrook, have been doing their thing. They did Daytona as a bit of an extra run. However, the number three car, the number three will be on a chassis that wasn't meant to be at Le Mans, because the chassis that was meant to be at Le Mans, which was the network spare, as I keep calling it, for Sebastian Bourdais, Renger van der Zande and Scott Dixon, was comprehensively disassembled by an accident that Renger had at Spa. That's gone back to the USA, and that will be fitted for IMSA racing, so that it can go racing in the 6 hours of at the Glen, the sailing 6 hours at the Glen. Therefore, the IMSA car was transferred into WEC spec with the various bits and pieces and sent out to Europe as quickly as possible. That said, Paul, you made the point about what you thought about the Cadillac. I've got to say that from seeing those cars testing, well, since Petit, after Petit last year, when they were going round in a semi-private test at Michelin Raceway Lagoon, at Michelin Raceway Road Atlanta, I like the way the cars look. I think they sound fantastic. They seem to ride the bumps and the curbs very well. Now, Le Mans is but nowhere near as bumpy as it used to be, but being able to ride the curbs at Le Mans has long been seen as an advantage if you can do that without doing damage.
No, that's very true. I mean, you're lucky in that you've seen the cars physically. I've been unfortunate. I haven't been able to see any of these cars actually in the flesh yet, this year's cars. But trawling through the data, I was surprised by how well the number two Cadillac had performed in the season so far. Particularly, you have to say, Earl Bamber, who... Yes, he's got the experience, but I thought perhaps was no longer the young gun that he was. But, you know, he spends as much of his time running Earl Bamber Racing as he does driving cars these days. But he's certainly lost none of his fire, and he hasn't forgotten how to drive racing cars either. And as I say, was very rapid indeed when he was behind the wheel of the Cadillac, both at Sebring and at Spa in particular. And... So, in a way, You know, you said a moment ago, you know, the surprise has been how well Ferrari has gone, but it has allowed Cadillac to get on with creating its own very rapid race car in a shadow, as it were, without everybody kind of raising expectations hugely. But let's just suppose we nail in Toyotas for first and second. I wouldn't go past putting a few pennies on Cadillac coming in and filling the third slot on the podium.
Yeah, and with Earl Bamber and Richard Westbrook, a couple of drivers who, up until fairly recently, particularly for Earl, were inextricably linked, with Porsche. Alex Lynn, a pretty safe pair of hands as well. That's a strong, strong team, and they have the experience of running in the championship. Well, there's some detailed rule changes about Le Mans this year, which we will mention in a wee moment's time. The second car with Sebastian Bourdais, Renger van der Zander and Scott Dixon, they've been plying their trade in the States. It gives Chip Ganassi Racing, who run Cadillac Racing, a real advantage in having a couple of cars. There's a third car also from IMSA, the number 311. It's 31 in the States. And this is Action Express Racing. And this will be Pipo Durrani, the exceptionally rapid Brazilian. Alexander Sims, real thinking driver, former BMW Works driver. And Jack Aiken, who's quick behind the wheel of anything. I think those three Cadillacs, for in some ways, three slightly different ways for those lineups. I think they all have their strengths, and they have slightly different strengths and very few weaknesses between them, to be honest, Paul. And I'm with you. I think they're a real threat, and having three of them there, rather than potentially just the one for the WEC entered car, I think that does make a difference as we approach the 100th anniversary of Le Mans.
Well, we've seen it before, haven't we? That the extra car is often, you know, an extra card up your sleeve that you can play as and when you need it. And all the teams we've spoken about so far with two car entries, Cadillac with three cars, and in a moment I'm going to come on and talk about a team that has four.
Yes, very interesting. Very interesting indeed, because that is Porsche Penske Motorsport, who have three cars, the two WEC cars and one of the IMSA cars. In addition, the first privateer entered manufacturer car, I think that's the fair way to say it. The Mighty 38 is back. It is Hertz Team Jota from Tunbridge Wells, Sam Hignett and the team. And must mention that this is a properly funded commercial effort. Hertz have backed this team. David Clark, who is the marketing and commercial guru there, has pulled an absolute blinder. They took the opportunity, Paul, we'll start with Hertz Team Jota, because they took the opportunity to race that car after basically having it sent up to Spa from being put together at Vysak. I'm not sure they even had a proper shakedown other than at the factory. And I think the best compliment I can give to both Porsche and to Hertz Team Jota is, well, I knew that Porsche customer racing has always been good and give their customers good cars. I think in some ways it was outstanding what Hertz Team Jota did with the car and how competitive they were. They put in the fastest Porsche race lap at Spa, and yet I'm not surprised really in the slightest that Sam and the team did that. That's the best compliment I can give them.
Yeah, I mean, there are some teams that you just expect to go well no matter how difficult you make their path or how many obstacles you stick in their way. And Jota have made a speciality of overcoming obstacles in their career, in their efforts at long distance sports car racing, both at Le Mans and elsewhere. It was always going to be a difficult ask for them at Spa. They were never expecting to finish on the podium, even really. But they had to show up, and they knew as a team that they would learn far more by taking part in the race than by going along and going to a test track or sitting in the workshop and tweaking the car in the workshop. So go out there and race and maximise the gradient of that learning curve. So, yeah, I mean, it's a tall order for them again at Le Mans. Again, I think that they're looking at a top six type of result rather than a podium result. But just getting to the end, I think, of a race like Le Mans is in itself a tall order. But it's a reflection of the car.
I like what Sam said. He said, Sam Hignett said to me at the livery launch and when I've seen him as well at the racetracks, he said, we're a race team, not a test team. We want to be out there. And he said, and think about it this way. This time next year will be the only privateer Porsche team that's already done Le Mans.
There you go.
And I think that is and potentially they'll have two cars next year, I think. They'll want Antonio Felix da Costa and Will Stevens staying with the programme, known quantities, both very quick drivers. To some of you who are listening here to 91.2 FM Haggerty Radio Le Mans for 2023, Yves Yates might be slightly less well known. I can tell you he's no less rapid. His rise through the ranks of single-seater racing and talent spotted by Porsche has been stratospheric. He was put into a sports car to try him out in the Asian Le Mans series, which he promptly went out and started winning races and championships. He has been taken under the wing of Porsche Motorsport Asia Pacific, and he is one of their selected drivers, so sort of a driver development program, which Porsche down through the years have done very well indeed. He's been to Le Mans before, Paul, and he's suffered the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, hasn't he, of Le Mans. So he'll go there with his eyes wide open. He's there's not a lot for him to learn other than the car and his new teammates, and he's driven with his new teammates in LMP2 in the early part of the season before the 963 turned up. I don't see him as a weak link here.
No, not at all. As you say, he may not be as familiar a name as the other two, but you know, if you're paying attention to motorsport generally, then you'll have heard of him. And if you're at Le Mans in 2021, of course, you will remember the tragic situation that befell. I think he was actually in the car.
He was.
When it stopped on the last lap.
WRT LMP2. Yeah.
The WRT car. Interesting facts that nobody cares about, number 100. In the 2021 Le Mans 24 Hour race, Yves Yates completed the most overtakes in the LMP2 class, 315 over the course of 24 hours. Think about that, 315 overtaking moves over the course of the 24 hours. That's what people love about Le Mans, is the number of overtaking.
Well, of course, he wasn't in for 24 hours, so he would have been in about a third of the race for that. That's, you know, not all of those were for position, dear listener. That wouldn't have been. They were at the sharp end of the field from pretty early on in the race. I look at that car and I can't help thinking that this is a freebie for them this year. I know they've got a lot of Hertz people coming over, but there's no real expectation from outside the Hertz team, Jota Garage. If I know Sam Hignett at all, and you and I have known him for quite a long time, that may not be the case inside the garage. But I see a relaxed Hertz team, Jota. When I've spoken to Sam, he's been quite, when are you going to get the car? We'll have it for Spa. Really? Thomas Laudenbach, who's the Porsche Motorsports boss, says, you might not. No, we'll have it for Spa, and we'll race it at Spa. How close do you have to have it? Look, it'll just happen, honestly. We'll make it happen. And I get that feeling that they're sort of like, well, you know, we're here. We're happy to be here. We've got the car out there. That's that box ticked. Let's see what we can do. And as I say, I don't see that there's a lot of pressure on their shoulders.
No, it's interesting. I mean, you talked about the team being a racing team, not a testing team. And I feel the same way, that they actually get the fun, if you will, out of it by going racing.
Yeah, absolutely right. They're up against, of course, and who would really want to pick this? And I've asked Sam this question many times, and we'll ask him at Le Mans, actually, and you can hear him on 91.2 because his answer's always very good. Porsche Penske Motorsport. So this is a works team The 5 and the 6 car at Le Mans are the two WEC entries. They run out of Germany. Dane Cameron, Michael Christensen and Fred McAvecky are in the 5 car. The 6 car is Kevin Estra, Andre Lotterer and Lawrence Vanthoor. Added to that is the 75 for the 75th anniversary of the first Porsche road car, which is this year, 60th anniversary of the Porsche 911 as well. So they've got a lot of celebrating to do. Philippe Nasr, Mathieu Jaminet and one Nicholas Tandy, Nick Tandy from Bedfordshire in the centre of England. That's the one of the US cars that is coming over. Wasn't originally planned to be there, but Christian Reed and Proton decided pretty early that they weren't going to come to Le Mans. They wanted to do more testing. And I think rather than give that Porsche entry up, Porsche Penske Motorsport and Porsche decided that it would be a good idea to have a third works car, making four in total. It's formidable, Paul. But one thing I would say is Penske, in the long races when they were with Acura, did not necessarily do their best work. Yes, they won championships, but they weren't always the best in the longer races. They've got Porsche on board here. They're running both of those programs. That perhaps wasn't favourite to happen here in Europe. Another team were very close to getting that. I don't know what to say about this. It's a new program. It's certainly not the fastest car in terms of race pace. But there's part of me that says you can't back against Porsche in the 24 hours of Le Mans.
Indeed. No, I mean, I hear what you say, more precisely what you're not saying. But, you know, Porsche has a formidable reputation at Le Mans, won the race more times than anybody else. So, you know, you're not going to write them off. And with four cars in the entry, and I don't know, there's just something about having Nick Tandy in that third car.
Yes.
Sort of thing. Where have I seen that before?
Yes.
But, you know, you can't always use superstitions like that. Although, funnily enough, it does sometimes hold water. There are some teams that are just good at doing long distance racing, you know, and Jota spring to mind as being a good example of that. Despite what we were just saying, WRT, who are not here at Le Mans this year, but they're
in LMP2, yes.
Yes.
They're not here with the hypercar for next year.
Hypercar.
Correct, yes. Testing it at the moment, I hear.
Good. But there are those teams that do endurance racing and get it right, or at least are in the right place when everything else falls apart. I would like to think, because I kind of think about these things in this way, just suppose it rains at Le Mans.
Yeah.
Q.
No, I'm not saying it.
Okay. And it turns into being a bit of a, I don't know, a crash fest, and there's lots of attrition and things. That's the kind of time when you'd expect Porsche to rise to the front.
Yes.
And that's the kind of time when having four cars is a very sensible idea indeed. And
yes,
you look at Toyota and you look at Ferrari and think, wonder why they didn't enter four cars. Well, we know the reasons. But so what Porsche does, you know, it's always sensible. It always has logic, you know, that Germanic logic to it. Their performances thus far haven't quite been on the pace, though. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to have to nail performance and reliability, mm-hmm, if they're going to be in a position to take advantage if the other ones are going to fall by the wayside.
Yep.
And I just have my fears that it's Porsche that are going to be the victims of that attrition rather than the Ooh. Beneficiaries of that attrition.
I'm here. Right, I'm going to remind you of that. I think that's a very interesting thing. I'm writing that down. victims rather than beneficiaries of the attrition. That's going to get rolled out definitely over the race weekend. Those are all the hybrid cars. I did mention there were some non-hybrid entries in the hypercar. This is not old cars. Again, if you're not familiar with this, these aren't old cars. These are built to the current regulation. And a hybrid system is not mandatory. There are slightly different regulations for that. Two different versions, two different teams and manufacturers here. We'll take Glickenhaus first because we know a little bit more about them. Jim Glickenhaus, very wealthy Hollywood mogul and producer. He's been here before. He's got two entries, importantly, the 708 and the 709. 708 is the full season entry, although we've seen full season entries, not be full season entries from Glickenhaus before. I'd be interested to see how many they run after Le Mans. That's Romain Dumas, Ollie Platt, and Ryan Briscoe. The second car is Franck Mayer, Nat Berton, and Esteban Gutierrez, the Mexican drivers, two Frenchmen and a Mexican. It's French heavy in there. I suspect there'll be a lot of support from the French crowd here at Le Mans. Last year, they struggled mightily to get that brake-by-wire system to work, and that certainly affected them this time last year in the race. The cars were put away at the end of last season and had very little, if any, development on them. There has been some testing and some racing for these cars in the early part of this year, but ultimately, this is last year's car. It has not been further developed, although Romain Dumas, talking to me at some length at Sebring, was at pains to say they understand the car far better than they did before. They have had podium finishes in the WEC. If I'm brutally honest, I think they'll do very well to be able to repeat that in the hypercar class at Le Mans this year.
Absolutely. I mean, you say that it's not necessarily that the non-hybrid hypercar class is not necessarily old cars, but in the case of the Glickenhaus, it is very much last year's car.
That's true.
However, it has been making progress, mm-hmm. And they have been in the three races that we've had in the season so far, stepping closer and closer to the pace of the front of the field. So, and unlike earlier on, I was saying some other teams who have stayed still or dropped away, Glickenhaus has, with their 708 car, very much taken forward steps as the season has progressed. And Jim will be taking some solace with that. But I mean, last year was, yes, they had difficulties in the WEC last year, but to finish Le Mans third and fourth, as the two Glickenhauses did, dream for Jim Glickenhaus.
Totally.
I mean, that justified him coming back here for the next 10 years. because he is that kind of enthusiast who's driven by the passion for the sport and the magic of Le Mans. And of the Nürburgring before he kind of took the step to Le Mans.
Well, he didn't send the car to the Nürburgring this year, and I spoke to him about this because he felt that it would be detrimental to the Le Mans effort. And you've got to be pragmatic about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I get exactly what he said, and that's absolutely right. But he certainly, you have to admit that he plied his trade at the Nürburgring and learnt about what this thing called endurance racing was all about and the magic of it and
that's
going through the night
point.
And all of that. And Jim loves it. The cars, you're right, they'll be a fan favourite no matter what. Even if the drivers, yes, you say it's a French heavy team. But, you know, that doesn't matter. We all cheer for the underdog.
Yeah.
The Glickenhaus is an underdog. And it's just a nice name, isn't it? I mean, Ferrari has magic about it, but, you know, the word Glickenhaus has a certain magic about it as well.
Do you know what? Jim would be delighted to hear you say that, to be honest. He hasn't quite fulfilled everything. I know how much he wants to get a customer car to Le Mans. That hasn't quite happened, and in some ways, circumstances are beginning to overtake him, particularly with Porsches being available and potentially from the other manufacturers as well. But isn't this what Le Mans all about in some respects, Paul? If there's room on the grid, surely there has to be room on the grid for somebody like Jim Glickenhouse?
Very much so, yes. One of the measures, if you like, for success of the Le Mans 24 Hours to me is the number of different chassis manufacturers we have.
Yeah.
And the number of different brand names that are out there. Hypercar is great this year for the first time for a long time. What have we got? 7 different manufacturers names represented compared to LMP2. I think it's important that Glickenhouse is there in a Glickenhouse. However, like you, I suspect, if Jim could get his hands on a 963, then he'd be very happy to do so.
Ferrari, maybe. He does like his Ferraris, doesn't
That's
he?
True. That's true, yes.
Yes.
It's a privateer Ferrari, why not? In the spirit of Ecurie Francorchamps or something like that.
Yes, absolutely. That leaves us with one car. It's the number 4. This is the Colin Collis team. They have entered the WEC this year as Floyd Van Wall Racing Team. And the car under the Austrian flag is listed as a Van Wall Vandevelde 680. I say that because there will be people who say he's not allowed to call it that. I am reading what is on the entry list. Tom Dillman, Esteban Guerrieri, the Argentinian, and Tristan Vautier in that car. Not much to the Canadians' displeasure, Jacques Villeneuve, who's been turfed out for Le Mans. In fairness, his wife is very close to her due date for the birth of their child, but it appears that the communications in that team were, to quote Ron Dennis, somewhat suboptimal, and it looks from a number of reports to say that Mr. Villeneuve will not be part of that team for the rest of the season. He feels somewhat slighted on that. Tristan Vautier drafted in, by no means a lesser driver. All of these drivers, by the way, are platinum drivers, so they're all at the top. I think there's only one non-platinum. No, there's 2 non-platinum drivers. Ifeanyi in the Hertz Team Jota and Franck Moyeur in the second of the Glickenhouses, and along with his teammates,
Tom Dillman's a gold, I think, isn't he?
Is Tom Dillman a gold? You're right. Yes. So those 3 are gold. So there's 3 gold drivers in this category. I don't know what to say about these guys. They've not had a lot of luck. The car, when it has gone, has not been too bad. Jacques Villeneuve seems to have had the worst of the luck. He had a brake disc explode on him at Portimao, and that shoved him off. He had a gearbox and transmission issue as he was taking the car out of the pits in the, I think it was the first session at Sebring. Colin Collis is a survivor. He's got this program together. It's a pretty nice looking racing car. I just don't know. And there will be people who will remember the bi-Collis efforts of down through the years, and they'll be readying the memes for what they feel the inevitable disasters occur to that car. And I feel for them for that, because I feel, in amongst everything else and all the issues with the naming rights, etc., you know, they've made an effort. They've built a car. It exists.
Yes, exactly. And all the things we said about Glickenhouse can be said about the Van Wall as well. It is an emotive name, although not necessarily as a sports car. But Colin Collis putting the team together, and it's important to have these extra cars in the field. To my mind, it opens up the field. As I said, when we were talking about Glickenhouse, as long as they're not a danger, and as long as they're not getting in the way, as long as they're reasonably well on the pace, then that's fine. I think it's when they become an embarrassment, and I'm thinking, when was it, late 1980s, early 90s, we had a BRM that showed up and really wasn't ready to race. I hope the Van Wall isn't in that state, but I know all those people who have sweepstakes running us to guess who the winner's going to be, and amongst those, you also have to guess who the first retirement's going to be. I wouldn't like that car to be the first retirement, because I'd like it to be able to be still running after 24 hours, because that's what it's here for. That's correct. The whole purpose of putting your entry in the first place. And for that car, being around at the end of the race will tick all the boxes it needs to tick. Hmm. And who knows, may even provide Colin Collins with enough money to go racing again next year. Yep. So, yes, it's an important element of the 24 hours of Le Mans. Is it going to finish? Well, that's 50-50 to my money. And yes, I mean, you've said everything about it. It's not a race winner. It doesn't have the experience of the team, although there's nothing wrong with any of the drivers. And Colin Collins has been running racing teams long enough to have got people involved. But you just know that there are going to be problems, don't you?
Yeah. Sure. And there will be people who will say, well, you know, why is that car there when the Vector Sport Isotta Fraschini did not get an entry? It was thought, I think, by the WEC, they didn't get an entry for the WEC either. It was thought the car wasn't going to be ready in time. They're still going through some testing with that car. Isotta Fraschini is another... hibernated brand of automotive. They did at least produce road cars, which I don't think Van Wall ever did. But they haven't produced anything near series road cars since the mid-1930s. But it's nice to see that brand revived. I think conventional wisdom says that when there is space at a race later in the season for the WEC, and there are more than 38 garages or fewer than 38 confirmed entries, it may well be that we'll see that Isotta Fraschini in the WEC field, and they'll be working towards being here and running at Le Mans next year. More variety is good. I think that's one thing that Paul and I have always agreed on down through the years. 16 cars, Paul, as we said, three different philosophies and rule sets. Absolute red-hot winners, Toyota Gazoo, red-hot favourites to win, Toyota Gazoo Racing, all things being equal, at which point you normally pop up and say, yes, but all things are not always equal in 24-hour racing in particular. You said something earlier on that reminded me of the late and much-missed Charlie Lamb from Schnitzer, BMWs mainly, and said to me once in a paddock in the States when they were racing in the old American Le Mans series, look, there's only two types of people as far as I'm concerned in the world. People who understand and enjoy and relish the challenge of 24-hour racing, and everybody else, which I thought was great. I think up and down this paddock, we've got lots more of the former than the latter. Is there going to be a big surprise, Paul, outside of Toyota? I mean, really, it would have to be something dramatic, but dramatic in Toyota, you know, we've seen that before. If there is going to be a surprise, what is it going to be and where does it come from in hypercar?
I can't tell you because then it won't be a surprise.
That's a good point.
Ferrari and Cadillac are the closest in terms of pace to the Toyotas. Ferrari and Cadillac are probably the closest in terms of efficiency as well. Mm-hmm. So Toyota are going to have to be on top of their game for the 24 hours. And if they're not, then they're going to have some people snapping on their heels. The 15-minute pit stop rule is one that I always like to apply, and that's about a 1% difference. So if you've got an advantage of 1% in performance over the rest of the field, then you can afford a 15-minute pit stop.
Yeah.
Now, both Ferrari and Cadillac have the ability to be within 1% of the Toyotas.
Wow.
Porsche, funny enough, the number 6 car has performed somewhat better than the number 7 car this year.
Yeah.
But the number 6 car is also within that magic 1%. So if both Toyotas have that 15-minute pit stop whilst they repair something, or, heaven forfend, something goes wrong with one of the very many control systems, and there's some of those which are Toyota, some of those which are not Toyota, are to do with FIA equipment.
Which has happened this year, of course. And befell Toyota, yes, exactly. Good point.
And if one of those hiccups should happen and take 15 minutes to repair, then we could have a surprise on our hands. But who it will be, whether it will be Ferrari, whether it will be Cadillac, could it be Porsche? I don't know. And that's why I'm going to go to the race and have a thoroughly good time watching, because that's what it's about. The motorsport is not a given. You know, it's any form of sport. You know, you get upsets and you get shocks. Football's easy because if one team doesn't win, the other team does. Motor racing's slightly more complicated.
We do have draws in football, Paul. You know, no team has to.
So. Yeah, but you don't have a third place in football.
Not normally. No, the things would have had to have gone horribly wrong.
Let 62 teams on the field at once and give them one ball to play with.
Yeah,
what we do at Le Mans. 62 teams, you know, and 16 of them as hypercars. I think that's great. Just having 16 cars on the grid for hypercar is, for me, that's. You know, that's the best bit.
I want to finish with a couple of thoughts. And I'm going to say something here, and I'm sure, even though I say, please don't take this the way that you're going to take it, there will be some listeners that do it. In some ways, I almost want to say, look, let Toyota go and do their thing with the Gazoo Racing GR010 hybrid. We've seen great battles behind Toyota. And I'm not saying we ignore Toyota, absolutely not, but let's revel in what's going on further down the hypercar field, because I think we're going to have some really good battles between the different manufacturers. And also, I want to ask you very quickly before we wrap this up about the changes in regulations, particularly with safety cars, because Toyota, if they do get everything right, potentially could drive away from the field. However, with the changes in safety car regulations, And still three safety cars, but eventually everybody comes in to restart behind a single safety car, and there's wave buys as well in certain conditions, then absolute pace by Toyota this year might not actually be enough, because getting a lap on the field, should there be safety car interventions, is going to be harder than ever.
Yes.
Does that change the strategic thinking, Paul? This is what you have to do, because you look at racing like that, and when you're sitting in the back of a garage deciding strategy, this is a very different mindset than we've ever had at Le Mans.
Yeah, exactly. And briefly, whilst we've been talking for the last however long it's been, I'd forgotten about it. I am not a big fan of the new safety car rules.
Because
of precisely what you've just said, that despite their pace, Toyota could end up having a race on their hands because the safety car has bunched everybody up again. And unless they get a lap on the field, then the result is always going to be in jeopardy. And I just find that a little bit manipulated. Where what I would dearly like is for the race to run without any safety cars at all.
The problem is, though, Paul, when you have three safety cars, and we've seen this happen before, and it normally happens in one of the other two classes to the top class, you can have a race decided by which safety car you get picked up behind.
Yeah.
And this is why this has been brought in, to mitigate that. And that might help the GTE arm battle and the LMP2 battle. But it'll be, there we go, we're back to the who gets the benefit and who gets the detriment.
Exactly. Why should the leader always be the one that loses out when a safety car gets deployed? You know, if you're in the lead and the safety car gets deployed, then your race has just been compromised. And I can understand why that's tremendously frustrating for the leader, but equally I can understand why people may say, oh yes, but that makes the race more exciting. Well, it does, but it's a constructed, it's a construed situation rather than it being a free-for-all. There's enough in the toolbox with yellow flags, with slow zones, so that they don't need to use a safety car, in my view.
So
I'm going to keep my fingers crossed that we don't have a safety car, because as soon as we get a safety car, I can guarantee you I'm going to throw my pen down crossly.
Hope I'm not sitting next to you when that happens, sitting off to your right. It could go anywhere.
Rebound.
Yes, absolutely. Paul Truswell has been joining me, John Hangdorf, as we've looked at the head of the field, the hypercars for the 23-24 hours of Le Mans. Plenty to get our teeth into here on Haggerty Radio Le Mans, 91.2 FM around the circuit, around the world on RS1. And if you're in North America and you are suitably equipped on the weekend, all day Saturday and through to the end of the race on Sunday, it's Sirius Channel 136 and XM202. Stories still to be written, and you'll find out all about it here every minute live from test day. Thanks for joining us.
This program is a Radio Show Limited production.
Tell your friends there's more at RadioLeMans.com.